On the dawn of March 29th, 1999, Simi Valley's quiet Granby Avenue held its breath. Lindsay Wells, 9 months pregnant and nestled in bed beside her fiancé and his mother, vanished without a trace. She left only her wallet and keys behind, but her ID, engagement ring, even her swollen fingers, abandoned. No one saw her leave, no one heard her cry out. By midday, her fiancé assumed she'd run errands, but she never returned. A trusted friend was left baffled. 3 missed appointments. A silent house. An unsolved mystery echoing through the desert hills. Cadaver dogs alerted near the Santa Susana Mountains. Law enforcement stalled. Witnesses stayed quiet. 2 decades passed. And still, the truth eludes us. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. The Last Morning. The sun rose gently over Simi Valley, casting a warm glow on the quiet neighborhood of Granby Avenue. Birds chirped lazily from the trees. Trash bins waited neatly by the curbs. For most, it was just another Monday. But for Lindsay Wells, March 29, 1999, was supposed to be one of the most important days of her life. She was 27, 9 months pregnant, and just days away from delivering her first child, a boy she'd already named Cameron. Lindsay was living with her fiancé John Rivera and his mother Ellen. Their home sat tucked away at the end of the block, cozy but small, with yellowing curtains and the kind of clutter that comes from waiting for a newborn. Diapers, tiny socks, formula samples, and a borrowed crib pushed against the living room wall. But that morning, Lindsay was gone. She'd gone to bed the night before, in her usual spot. Curled on her side, pillows wedged behind her back, belly taut with the weight of life. John had told police he was awake when she left, sometime before sunrise, said she needed some air, said she walked out the front door in her nightgown, without shoes, purse, or phone. He never called out after her. At 10:45 a.m., Lindsay was supposed to meet her best friend, Tara Hughes, at the obstetrician's office. It was the final appointment before delivery. But Lindsay didn't show. Tara waited 40 minutes, then called Lindsay's home. No answer. She tried again an hour later. Still nothing. That wasn't like Lindsay. She was always early, always careful, especially now. By mid-afternoon, Tara drove to Granby Avenue. John answered the door, groggy and casual. When Tara asked where Lindsay was, he shrugged. "She probably went out," he mumbled. "She does that sometimes." But she didn't. Not without telling Tara, not this close to giving birth. Inside, everything looked too normal. Lindsay's favorite sweater still lay over the recliner. Her prenatal vitamins sat uncapped beside a glass of water. Her sneakers were by the door. Her purse, wallet, and ID were untouched on the counter. Her engagement ring, tight from swelling, was resting in a small ceramic dish, like it always was at night. But Lindsay? Gone. Tara contacted the police that evening. At first, they treated it as a voluntary disappearance. "She's an adult," the officer told her, "and pregnant women do strange things under stress." But Lindsay wasn't strange. She was grounded, gentle. She journaled every day, wrote letters to her unborn son, and clipped parenting tips from magazines. She was preparing, not panicking. And she would never leave without her prenatal meds or her baby. That night, the house was sealed. Detectives arrived the next morning. The media didn't. There was no Amber Alert, no urgent press conference, no dramatic plea from John. Just a 1-page missing person bulletin posted at the corner store. One by one, neighbors learned what had happened, not from authorities, but from whispers. "I saw her walking her dog last week," said the woman next door. "She looked tired but happy." "John didn't even seem worried," someone else muttered. "I heard they were fighting." Police questioned John. He repeated the same story. "She left early. No idea where. He thought she'd come back." But something didn't add up. By Wednesday, officers requested cadaver dogs. They started with the house. Nothing. Then the yard. Still nothing. But when they led the dogs to a trail near the Santa Susana Mountains, less than 3 miles away, one of them alerted strongly. Authorities flagged the area, took samples, and moved on. No body was found. Back at home, Ellen, the fiancé's mother, told officers she hadn't heard a thing, claimed she slept through the night. But Tara remembered something else. Lindsay once told her she felt uncomfortable around Ellen, that the woman had been acting strangely protective of John, that sometimes Lindsay would find her standing outside their bedroom door at night. "She gave me the creeps," Lindsay had said, "like she wanted me gone." Police filed the missing person report. Days passed, then weeks. No surveillance footage, no witnesses, no scent trail, no signs of a break-in, and no sign of Lindsay's body. The investigation stalled. John stopped cooperating. Ellen hired a lawyer, and the media, still silent. It was as if Lindsay had never existed. 10 years later, the trail remains cold. But stories persist. A former neighbor claims she saw a dark SUV idling outside the house that morning. A retired detective insists something was buried in the Santa Susana trail system, and a woman in a nearby town believes she spoke to Lindsay, alive, years after the disappearance. Maybe it was all speculation. Maybe not. But one thing was certain. Someone was lying. And in the vacuum of truth, the silence screamed louder than words. Chapter 2. Echoes in the Mountains. The Santa Susana Mountains stretched like sleeping giants under the California sun, rugged, dry, and laced with trails that twisted into silence. On April 2, 1999, just 4 days after Lindsay Wells vanished, this was where the cadaver dogs barked and froze. It wasn't random. It was urgent. One dog pawed the dirt near a shallow depression beside a rock cluster. Another whimpered and paced. Detectives marked the site with yellow flags. Forensic teams arrived. The soil was scraped and bagged. Samples sent to labs. But nothing visible was found. No body, no clothing, no DNA. The media never caught wind. And by the next day, search efforts were pulled back. Behind the scenes, frustration mounted. Veteran officer James Delaney, who had worked missing persons for over a decade, quietly voiced his doubts to a colleague. "It's not just that she's gone, it's how quickly they're letting it go." Back in Simi Valley, Tara Hughes became the default investigator. Every day after work, she returned to Granby Avenue, speaking with neighbors, collecting statements, pushing for answers. She even started her own logbook, page after page of handwritten notes. On April 5th, she interviewed an elderly woman 3 doors down. "She told me Lindsay was crying the night before she vanished," Tara later recalled. She said Lindsay stood in the driveway barefoot, arguing with someone in a white tank top. Said she recognized John's voice, loud, sharp. Then it stopped, just like that. The woman never called police, said she didn't want to get involved. There was more. Tara tracked down a gas station attendant near the Santa Susana trail entrance. He remembered a man matching John's description, buying duct tape and trash bags, the morning Lindsay went missing. He hadn't reported it at the time. It didn't seem suspicious until weeks later. Tara passed the tip to detectives, but no warrant came. No follow-up. John Rivera, meanwhile, refused further interviews. Ellen declined entirely. Their home, once filled with baby clothes and soft lullaby tapes, was now sterile. The crib was gone, the ring dish empty, the photo of Lindsay once on the mantle replaced by a ceramic angel. They told friends they were trying to move on. But Tara refused to. She pushed the department to release a composite sketch, just in case someone had seen something. They said it wasn't necessary. She contacted local news outlets. Only one small station aired a segment. It ran at 11:45 p.m., buried between stories about a house fire and a stray mountain lion. For a while, Tara wondered if she was the only one still listening to the silence. Then came the anonymous letter. It arrived on April 14th, tucked inside her mailbox. No stamp. No return address. Just a torn piece of yellow legal paper. The handwriting was messy, almost childlike. "Check near the flood tunnels. She didn't leave. She was made to leave. Look for the broken bracelet." Tara showed it to police. They logged it, scanned it, and set it aside. But they didn't search, So she did. 2 days later, armed with a flashlight and a cheap pair of boots, Tara walked the drainage tunnels near the Santa Susana foothills. Water trickled, graffiti curled along the concrete walls. She searched for hours, until sunset, before finally stopping to rest under a low overpass. And there it was, caught between rocks and dry leaves, a silver charm bracelet, rusted, bent, but unmistakable. It had a single heart-shaped charm, engraved with the letter L. Tara's hands trembled. She turned it in immediately. Detectives took it. They logged it. Then, silence again. Weeks passed. No update. When Tara called, she was told the bracelet was under review. She never heard another word about it. By May, Lindsay's case had slipped from active rotation. Simi Valley PD labeled it open but inactive. No leads, no arrests, no answers. But Tara kept searching. She reached out to an independent private investigator named Malcolm Keane, who agreed to look into the case pro bono. He'd worked child abduction cases and cold files across the state. Something about Lindsay's story got under his skin. She didn't run, he told Tara. She was removed, cleanly, by someone who knew how to make it look like nothing. His theory? The disappearance wasn't a one-man job. He suspected John had help, possibly Ellen, possibly someone else entirely, someone who knew the terrain, someone who had time before police were notified. That window, between 5 a.m. and 10:45 a.m., was wide enough to erase a person. In June 1999, the forensic report from the Santa Susana site quietly came back. The soil had traces of human decomposition, faint, degraded, but present. It was enough for a new warrant. But it never came. Tara was told the evidence was inconclusive. The file was closed again. And just like that, it was over. Or so they thought. Because a year later, a construction worker digging near a canyon trail uncovered something strange. A lock of hair, braided and tied with a faded pink ribbon. It matched Lindsay's hair color. The sample disappeared in evidence processing. No match was ever announced. No one claimed it. Chapter 3. The Quiet Suspects. The truth about who might have made Lindsay Wells disappear didn't scream. It whispered. It whispered through body language, through silence, through the way John Rivera blinked too slowly when asked simple questions, or how Ellen Rivera never once referred to Lindsay by name after her disappearance. For investigators who knew how to read the unsaid, the walls of that Simi Valley home were louder than words. But suspicion, without evidence, is like a gun with no bullets. It might look threatening, but it won't make an arrest. John Rivera was 29 when Lindsay went missing. Tall, wiry, and soft-spoken, he worked as a heating technician, mostly on-call contracts around Ventura County. Friends described him as laid-back, private, decent. But Tara Hughes remembered something else entirely. He had a temper, she told the private investigator, Malcolm Keane. I'd see it in flashes, like lightning, 1 minute calm, the next cold and sharp. He didn't yell. He punished with silence, with distance. That's how he controlled her. Control. That word surfaced again and again in the notes Malcolm compiled. When he reviewed Lindsay's journals, which Tara had recovered from her apartment before they were cleaned out, subtle patterns began to appear. At first, just entries about pregnancy, plans, worries. Then, around January, something darker. He doesn't want to go to the appointments with me anymore, says the baby's making me act crazy. Ellen watches me all the time. I can't even cry without hearing her outside the door. Sometimes I feel like I'm not even here. Those were the final entries. Ellen Rivera, John's mother, was a stoic woman, late 50s, former medical assistant. She moved in with her son shortly after Lindsay became pregnant. At first, she was helpful, cooking meals, folding laundry, running errands. But then, things shifted. She started throwing away the baby books I bought, Tara recalled. She said they were outdated, that she knew better than some book. Ellen took over the nursery, repainted the walls, replaced Lindsay's selections with her own. She referred to the baby as my boy. She treated Lindsay like a surrogate, said one friend. Not a mother, just a vessel. When questioned by police, Ellen claimed she'd slept through the morning Lindsay disappeared. She heard nothing, saw nothing, and later said she assumed Lindsay had gone to visit a friend, but she couldn't name which friend, couldn't remember what time she realized Lindsay was gone. Her story stayed vague, unchanging. Malcolm wasn't satisfied. He pulled records of Ellen's prior addresses. One stood out, an apartment complex in Ventura, where 15 years earlier, a young woman had filed a restraining order against her, claiming verbal harassment and intimidation. The reason? The woman had dated Ellen's son briefly, and then broken up with him. That report never made it into the original missing person file. John, meanwhile, grew more distant. 2 months after Lindsay vanished, he quit his job. By fall, he moved out of state, first to Nevada, then briefly to Arizona. Each time police tried to follow up, he said he had nothing more to add. That he was grieving, that he wished people would move on, but he never posted a missing flyer, never joined a search party, never mentioned Lindsay on social media. He disappeared in spirit, just as Lindsay had in body. Malcolm kept digging. He followed the money, discovered a series of strange bank withdrawals from Lindsay's joint account in the weeks after she went missing. Small amounts, always from out-of-town ATMs. When flagged by the bank and reported to police, the trail went cold. The surveillance footage was erased by the time anyone asked for it. There was also a life insurance policy, small, only $10,000, but taken out by John on Lindsay just a month before her disappearance. The beneficiary? Himself. That raised eyebrows. But again, no body meant no proof of death. And so the policy went unclaimed. Still, it added to the pile of red flags. Then came a chilling break, buried in a forgotten tip line voicemail. In 2005, an anonymous caller claimed to have overheard two men talking at a bar in Henderson, Nevada, about a girl in California who got taken care of. The man mentioned the name John and said his mom helped clean it up. The voicemail was never traced. It sat, archived, until Malcolm filed a FOIA request and discovered it in 2008. But one name hadn't been investigated at all, Miles Barrett, a high school friend of John's. He'd crashed on their couch a few times, helped John with home repairs, and had a reputation for staying just barely on the right side of the law. When Tara brought him up in her notes, she mentioned something odd. I remember one night, Lindsay called me whispering, said Miles was in the house drunk, that John wasn't home. She locked herself in the bathroom until he left. When police finally looked into him, Miles had already left California. He was now living in a trailer park near Tucson under a different last name. When Malcolm reached him by phone, Miles hung up. 3 days later, his number was disconnected. In 2010, the case was reopened briefly under a cold case task force. A new detective reviewed the file, but after 6 months, the case returned to inactive. No new evidence, no forensic update, no witness confessions. The suspects remained the same. John, Ellen, Miles, each living a life in the shadows of a truth they refused to share. Chapter 4. Whispers in the Journal. There are two sides to every story, and then there are the pages we never read. Tucked deep inside a faded pink shoebox beneath Tara Hughes's bed lay a second journal, one that Lindsay Wells had never intended for anyone else to see. It wasn't the neatly written pregnancy tracker her family knew about. This one was raw, handwritten in fast loops, smudged with tears. It began in December of 1998, 3 months before she vanished. Lindsay had hidden it behind old nursing books in her bedroom closet. Tara only found it after convincing Lindsay's sister to let her help clear the house before the landlord reclaimed it. The shoebox held sonogram photos, a half-written baby name list, and the journal. The first line read, "I think something is wrong, not with the baby, with John." The entries painted a portrait no police report ever could. He says, "I talk too much, that I stress the baby out. I asked him to rub my back and he just walked away." Ellen said it was selfish to want a water birth, said real women deliver the way God intended, in pain. "I saw John on the phone in the garage again. He slammed it shut when I walked in." He doesn't touch me anymore, not even my hand. But it was the entry dated March 24th, just 5 days before she vanished, that sent chills through Tara's spine. Last night I dreamed I was buried alive. I screamed, but no one came. When I woke up, Ellen was standing in the hallway just watching me, didn't say a word. I pretended to be asleep. I think she wants me gone. Tara copied the entire journal into digital format and emailed it to Malcolm Keane. He read it twice before calling her at 2 a.m. She knew, he said flatly. She didn't have proof, but she knew something was about to happen. The final page had no date, just a few hurried lines, almost illegible. If something happens to me, don't let him raise my baby. Malcolm brought the journal to the Simi Valley Cold Case Division. He hoped it would be enough to reopen the case. It wasn't. They logged it as emotional testimony, not hard evidence. One detective, off the record, told him, "We need a body. Everything else is noise." In the months that followed, Malcolm and Tara worked to amplify that noise. They contacted podcasts, independent journalists, true crime forums. One Reddit thread gained traction, drawing dozens of users who began combing through satellite maps of the Santa Susana Mountains, rechecking possible burial sites. A retired ranger even came forward. He'd been stationed near Box Canyon in early 1999 and remembered seeing a man in a white pickup truck digging near a remote slope one morning. He didn't think much of it then, assumed it was a hiker or a camper clearing fire pits. But when shown a photo of John Rivera from 1999, the ranger hesitated. "That's him," he finally said. "Or it could have been. The jawline is right. Hair was longer, though." No photo was ever recovered from that moment. No footage, just memory. Tara also pushed for a re-examination of the charm bracelet. It had been kept in evidence storage for years, with no forensic testing ever completed. Malcolm filed a formal request. Weeks later, the results came back. Trace DNA was found on the inside of the clasp. Partial match. Female. Consistent with Lindsay's genetic profile. It should have been a breakthrough. Instead, the case status remained unchanged. The reason? The DNA wasn't enough for prosecution. The chain of custody was uncertain. The bracelet had not been collected by police at the time, but turned in by a civilian. The evidence, they said, was contaminated by default. Tara broke down crying in her car the night she got that news. But the journal had one last breadcrumb. In one entry, Lindsay had written, "Miles came over again. Brought beer for John. I told him I was tired. He stared at my belly and said, 'You sure that baby's his?' I asked him to leave. John laughed and said, 'Ignore him, he's just drunk.' But I saw something in his eyes." That entry triggered a new theory. What if the motive wasn't only control, but doubt? Malcolm traced Miles Barrett to a tiny town outside Kingman, Arizona. He worked part-time at an auto salvage yard under the name Mike B. No legal ID, no bank account, paid in cash. Malcolm drove out there, parked nearby, and waited for a shift change. When Miles stepped out, Malcolm approached with a photo of Lindsay. "Remember her?" he asked. Miles froze, looked at the picture, then back at Malcolm. "No idea who that is," he said. But his voice cracked. Malcolm asked him directly, "Where were you the morning she disappeared?" Miles didn't answer. Instead, he turned and walked away. 3 days later, Miles quit the salvage job. He left town without picking up his final paycheck. No one's seen him since. Chapter 5, Beneath the Surface. Summer had come to Simi Valley, and with it, a strange silence. The heat shimmered off the pavement. The smell of dry grass lingered in the air. And somewhere beneath the surface of this ordinary suburban landscape, secrets festered. Secrets wrapped in the dirt of the Santa Susana Mountains. Secrets sealed in silence. Lindsay Wells had been gone for over a decade now, but the mystery of her disappearance refused to fade. What had begun as a whispered tragedy was slowly gaining volume, amplified by digital sleuths, determined friends, and a private investigator who refused to let her story die. And then came the call. It was late August 2011 when Tara Hughes's phone buzzed with a blocked number. She nearly didn't answer, but something in her gut told her to pick up. A man's voice, shaky and low. "Is this the girl looking for Lindsay?" Tara froze. "Who is this?" The man didn't give a name. "I was there," he said. "Not in the house, but after. I helped clean it up. I didn't know what I was getting into. I can't do this anymore." Tara pressed record on her second phone and put him on speaker. "Where is she?" she asked, barely breathing. The man paused. "You need to look near the old quarry, south side. You'll find part of her, maybe not all. They moved her once. Don't trust the dog alerts, they're wrong. She's deeper than that." Before Tara could ask anything else, the call ended. She traced the number. Burner phone. Untraceable. Malcolm Keane contacted Ventura County search and rescue teams. He mapped out every quarry south of Santa Susana. One stood out, the Bell Canyon dig site, an abandoned gravel pit closed in 1995. It was private property now, owned by a development firm, but largely untouched. He filed a request with the police to obtain search permission. It was denied. The tip wasn't deemed credible. So he did what he always did. He went alone. The Bell Canyon site was a hollowed-out expanse of rock and earth, surrounded by broken fencing and overgrown weeds. Malcolm arrived just before sunrise. He brought nothing but a camera, a metal detector, and a borrowed ground-penetrating radar unit from a retired search tech. By noon, the sun was relentless. But then, something registered, a depth anomaly. 2 feet wide, 5 feet long, 4 feet deep, roughly human-shaped. A disruption in the soil composition, distinct from the rest of the area. He flagged it, photographed it, logged GPS coordinates. Then he called the sheriff's department again. They told him, "We're reviewing the tip, but there's no immediate action planned." The site was never excavated. Meanwhile, Tara began receiving letters. No return address, handwritten in all caps. The first simply said, "You're looking in the wrong direction." The second, a week later, was more cryptic. "What if Lindsay isn't the only one?" And the third, "The mother knows." Tara turned all three over to the police. They ran fingerprint tests. No usable prints, no DNA, no further investigation. But Tara was convinced. The notes weren't from a stranger. They were personal. The tone, the phrasing. It felt like someone watching. Someone near. Malcolm revisited the files, dug deeper into Ellen Rivera's past. He found an overlooked connection. A former co-worker at the medical clinic, where she had worked in the 80s, had filed a workplace complaint. The reason? Emotional harassment and threatening behavior. The complaint never went anywhere, but in the document, there was one haunting sentence. She said she knew how to make people disappear. It wasn't a metaphor, it was a threat. Malcolm paid Ellen a visit. It was risky. She now lived in a quiet mobile home park in Modesto. He knocked on her door on a bright Saturday morning, clipboard in hand, pretending to be a health insurance agent. She opened the door halfway. Her eyes were sharp and dry. He asked a few fake questions. She answered them without blinking. Then he said, "I'm also working a cold case, Lindsay Wells. Do you remember her?" The look in her eyes shifted instantly, from ice to panic, then rage. "She's not your business," Ellen hissed. "She was unstable. She left." He nodded slowly. "Did she leave her own baby behind too?" Ellen slammed the door. That same week, a woman named Sandra Moen contacted Tara anonymously. She had seen a local news clipping about Lindsay's case and claimed she used to work with Ellen at a short-term elder care facility. "I overheard Ellen talking once," Sandra said. "She was whispering to someone on the phone, said, 'It's done, I told you she wouldn't survive it.' Then she laughed." Tara pressed her for more. Sandra hesitated, then added, "I think it had to do with a pregnancy." It had to be Lindsay. Back at the Bell Canyon site, the property had been sold. Construction was underway for a new residential development. Bulldozers cleared massive sections of land, regrading slopes, digging foundations. Malcolm raced to contact city planning to halt excavation at the GPS marker, but it was too late. By the time he returned to the site, the entire area had been paved. Whatever or whoever was beneath that soil was gone. Then came one final twist. A man named Robert Reyes, a former roommate of Miles Barrett, sent an email to the tip line. He said he had something Lindsay-related, a VHS tape left behind when Miles fled Arizona. Malcolm and Tara met him at a motel off Highway 15. The tape was labeled simply 1999/grab. On it was blurry handheld footage of a woman walking out of a house at night, visibly pregnant, barefoot. The footage shook. A man's voice whispered, "You got her?" Then static. It was hard to make out, but the woman's build, her walk, even her nightgown, it matched the missing person photos of Lindsay Wells. They turned the tape over to police. It was entered into evidence. The official conclusion: inconclusive footage, no definitive identification. Chapter 6. Buried evidence, buried truths. Some crimes fade with time. This one hardened. 12 years had passed since Lindsay Wells vanished without a trace. 12 years of unanswered questions. 12 years of rumors, dead ends, and silent suspects. But the silence wasn't empty. It was heavy. And now it was starting to crack. The tape had changed everything. Even if the footage was blurry and the woman's face unclear, for Tara and Malcolm, there was no doubt. It was Lindsay. The way she walked, how she held her swollen belly, her hunched shoulders from pain or fear. It was all there, captured just moments before everything went dark. The police called it inconclusive. Malcolm called it something else. The beginning of the end. He doubled down on his investigation, going over every file, every witness, every overlooked note. One line in the police report jumped out. No digital forensics conducted. No analysis of personal home devices requested at time of report. That meant Lindsay's old home computer, John's laptop, even their landline voicemail box, none of it had ever been examined. He filed a formal request to have the original devices recovered and analyzed, even if the data was degraded. The problem? The computer had been sold years ago in a garage sale. The laptop? Disposed of? The landline voicemail box? Disconnected, with no backup. Almost as if someone wanted every trace of Lindsay's last digital footprint erased. But one thing survived. Tara remembered Lindsay had used a floppy disk to save pregnancy photos. A relic, but maybe something was left. She dug through her own storage, and in a faded cardboard box marked College plus Lindsay, she found it, a single black disk labeled Cameron in Lindsay's handwriting. Malcolm bought an external floppy reader. They plugged it in and held their breath. 5 image files. 4 were grainy pictures of a nursery setup, crib, tiny socks, a giraffe mobile. The 5th was different. It was a blurry photo of a bathroom mirror, clearly taken in haste. Lindsay was in the foreground. Behind her, reflected in the mirror, was Ellen, standing in the doorway, watching. Lindsay's eyes looked wide, terrified. The timestamp? March 28, 1999, 11:42 p.m., hours before she disappeared. Malcolm turned the photo over to the district attorney's office. It was chilling, but still, the response was muted. "Compelling," they said. But circumstantial. The case remained open, but dormant. Still no arrest. Then came the break they hadn't dared to hope for. A construction worker named Diego Torres called the anonymous tip line. He had been part of the early team at Bell Canyon, assigned to clearing debris and leveling land for the development. While removing tree roots and compacted soil, he'd found something. A tiny white fabric bundle. Inside, bones. Small, fragile, child-sized. His supervisor took it, said he'd handle it. Diego never saw it again. But now, years later, he'd heard whispers about the Lindsay Wells case, about a pregnant woman, a baby never born, and something in his gut told him those bones mattered. Malcolm and Tara found him credible. But when they approached the company, no records of a recovered bundle or worker incident were found. The bones were gone. Tara broke down that night. She locked herself in her apartment, and sobbed into Lindsay's old sonogram photo, the only thing she still kept by her bed. "How can they keep doing this?" she whispered. "How many times does she have to be buried before someone listens?" Malcolm turned to the one tool he hadn't yet used, media pressure. He contacted 60 Minutes, unresolved, and a few high-profile true crime influencers on YouTube. One of them, a woman named Naomi Cruz, with over 4 million subscribers, agreed to produce a full-length special titled The Missing Mother Who Killed Lindsay Wells. It premiered on a Sunday evening and exploded across social media. Within 24 hours, hashtag Justice for Lindsay was trending. By the end of the week, the district attorney's office had received over 11,000 emails demanding the case be reopened. The spotlight burned bright, and in the heat of public outrage, someone finally cracked. A man walked into a sheriff's department in Henderson, Nevada, and asked to speak to someone in cold case. He gave a name, Kevin Marks, a former friend of Miles Barrett. He said he had kept a secret for too long. That in April 1999, Miles showed up at his door in the middle of the night, covered in dirt and panicking. He told Kevin, "I helped them move her." She wasn't dead yet. Kevin thought it was drugs or a bad trip. He didn't ask questions. But when the Lindsay Wells story exploded online, he couldn't live with it anymore. He gave police a location, said Miles had described a second burial site in the hills behind Topanga Canyon near a dried-up creek bed. Detectives responded quietly, privately. For the first time in years, official search dogs were deployed. On day two, one of the dogs alerted, hard. The dig was shallow, less than 4 feet deep, but the remains were clear. Partial skeletal fragments, a femur, pieces of a pelvis, a tooth, and fabric, white with tiny printed giraffes. The forensics team moved quickly, and 2 weeks later, the results came back. The remains were consistent with a full-term fetus, male, believed to be Cameron Wells. Lindsay still wasn't found, but part of her story had surfaced. Part of her was seen. Chapter 7, Justice or Silence. The discovery of Cameron Wells's remains changed everything, and nothing. It was the break Tara had prayed for. The moment Lindsay's story finally demanded a response that couldn't be shelved, ignored, or drowned in bureaucracy. But what she didn't expect was how slow justice still moved, even when a baby's bones screamed from the soil. For the Simi Valley Police Department, the discovery was the first physical evidence ever recovered. And still, no one was arrested. Not John, not Ellen, not Miles. Not even after Kevin Marks passed a polygraph. Not after cadaver dogs returned to Topanga Canyon and uncovered more bones, tiny rib fragments, a femur too small to be Lindsay's, but unmistakably fetal. The medical examiner ruled Cameron's death as likely homicide. But without Lindsay's body, without a confession, the DA insisted they didn't have enough. Tara wasn't shocked anymore, just numb. She stood at the burial site as forensic teams marked the ground with little yellow flags, her hands balled into fists at her sides. The only thing she could do was whisper into the dry breeze as if Lindsay could hear her. "We're not done." The media storm reignited. Dateline, 48 hours. Even Rolling Stone reached out. The case was suddenly everywhere. People demanded answers. Protesters gathered outside the district attorney's office, holding signs that read, "Say her name, Lindsay Wells. No body, no peace. This is not justice." And then another break. A local journalist named Nadia Quinn, digging through archived police evidence, uncovered something overlooked, a voicemail transcription from Lindsay's landline dated March 28, 1999 at 11:57 p.m. The message had been flagged as unrelated at the time, but when reviewed again, it hit like a bomb. "Hey, John, I don't think I can do this anymore. You and your mom, you're scaring me. I'm taking Cameron and going to Tara's. I need to feel safe again." Click. The timestamp was undeniable. She was planning to leave. She was scared. And she was still alive, less than 6 hours before she disappeared. Malcolm compiled every thread, every statement, timeline tip, voicemail, and forensic scrap, into a single 412-page file. He walked it directly into the office of Deputy DA Frances Myers. She sat in silence as he placed it on her desk, and then she looked up and said the words Tara had waited over a decade to hear. "We're reopening the case." On November 6th, 2012, nearly 14 years after Lindsay Wells vanished, John Rivera was arrested at a gas station in Henderson, Nevada. He was charged with second-degree murder, fetal homicide, and obstruction of justice. He said nothing during booking, just stared forward, jaw clenched. His attorney claimed the case was a witch hunt, that John had no history of violence, and that a person can disappear voluntarily, even pregnant. But the evidence was there now, and it had a name. Cameron. A week later, Ellen Rivera was taken into custody. She was charged with accessory to murder, tampering with evidence, and conspiracy to conceal a death. She screamed at reporters from the back of a police cruiser, "I did what I had to do. That baby wasn't right. She was going to ruin my son's life." The words echoed across the news cycle. The nation now had its villains. But the trial dragged. John's defense team pushed delays, claimed insufficient evidence, questioned the chain of custody on the bracelet, claimed the voicemail could have been faked, that the bones couldn't be conclusively tied to Lindsay. There was no body, no eyewitness. And without Lindsay's remains, the DA had one shot: convince a jury that Cameron's death was proof enough. It took a year to go to trial. 4 weeks of arguments, 16 witnesses, dozens of exhibits. The jury deliberated for 3 days, and on September 17, 2013, they returned their verdict. John Rivera, guilty on all counts. Ellen Rivera, guilty of accessory and tampering. Miles Barrett, never located. Still at large. John was sentenced to 37 years to life. Ellen received 15 years. The courtroom was packed with press and onlookers, but Tara didn't attend the sentencing. She was in Topanga Canyon, standing by the creek bed where Cameron had been buried. She held a bouquet of white lilies in one hand and Lindsay's old bracelet in the other. She placed the flowers in the water and whispered, "You were never forgotten. Not for one day." The remains of Cameron Wells were buried under his own name that fall. He was given a headstone that read, "Cameron Wells, born and lost, March 29, 1999. Your mother fought to bring you home." Lindsay's name was added to the stone. Her body was never found. But her story was, and in the end, that story became louder than the silence that had tried to bury her. Because someone listened and refused to stop.